The agenda for this session, I thought that now having covered some of the fundamentals of Aquinas on natural law, there are of course more texts that you read that we could discuss from questions 94, 95, 96, 97 about natural law and human law. And we can certainly get into those in the latter half of this session today and tomorrow. Certainly if you have questions about those, I'd like to hear them. But I thought maybe we'd start today by a little more dialogical discussion, so I'm hoping kind of seminar style, to talk about Aquinas' natural law approach versus other forms of natural law theories that you'd find, and then some kind of typical arguments that are often given to dispute Aquinas on natural inclinations, as we saw it yesterday. So we got a kind of first look at that. We could go deeper into that. But there are some very typical objections that you find, and maybe it would be fruitful for us to talk about that. So maybe we should just begin by contrasting Aquinas with other natural law theories. And part of the reason why it's helpful to do this is we have in the back of the room not only, is Dr. Capizzi? Oh, we've lost Dr. Capizzi. He's a real expert on some of these natural law theories. But also, of course, we have Professor Ramul here. He can give us his take on the way this is interpreted in contemporary jurisprudence. And visiting us is Dr. Philip Munoz, who's a professor at Notre Dame and has a joint appointment both in political theory and in the law school, and runs their Tocqueville program for constitutional studies, and also was my high school locker partner. So he has that going for him. And college roommate. So we're very old friends. We've been arguing about these things for, 25 years or more? Which seems hard to believe, but it's true. And he actually is, you know, can give a good defense of why we should not dismiss John Locke too quickly. Now, I think that's totally wrong. But anyway, we can... All right, so, but as I was saying, you know, we're good friends, so we can argue about these things and it doesn't threaten our friendship. To contrast Aquinas' natural law theory with other forms of natural law. So what we saw with Aquinas is that, what does nature... Maybe I just should ask you, can you re-articulate? What does Aquinas mean when he's talking about nature and speaking about natural law? What is natural about natural law for Aquinas? Yeah, Joseph.
The laws that concern natural things, such as human beings, exist within the eternal law, which is applied for the cosmos.
Okay, so it's about natural things. Say more about that, you or someone else. What about these natural things? Amy, you're on the verge of saying something there.
I mean, I guess it's, it takes from, it has an older, Aristotelian view that sees the telos in things, and so there's a naturalness or a plan to the way things unfold, idea of the thing, its form,
Yeah, okay, so you've articulated well here the idea that you don't just have sort of static things that are just kind of, you know, a collection of beings out there, and Aquinas sees them as coming from somewhere and going somewhere, and that when you look at natural realities, you immediately see that that's what's happening in nature, and that things are seeking their own perfection. Okay, so now, yes?
Is it right before I had read this, I had assumed natural law applied to everything. Is it right to say, though, that natural law for Aquinas specifically applies to the way that rational creatures participate in the eternal law, and that if we see a dog being a dog, that's part of the eternal law, but the natural law applies specifically to the way that rational creatures participate in the eternal law.
Yes, so he says this in different ways in different places, where he will say, well, yes, of course, you know, like brute animals participate in the natural law in a low way because they have inclinations that they more or less blindly follow. So they don't understand what they're doing. They just are moved, as it were, by their appetites to do it. Now, Aquinas doesn't think that, like, dogs are just, you know, being pushed or something like this. He thinks that their desires really emerge from within them, and he thinks that they have a memory and an emotional life, actually, which is why dogs can seem like they become your friend, because dogs are very empathetic creatures, as opposed to cats that are just like predators, right? So dogs are empathetic, and they sense your emotions, and they kind of mirror your emotions. So you can be very consoled by the presence of a dog who is very faithful. They're pack animals. They want to be with you. They're social, therefore. And they obviously have a memory because they can be trained. So it's not that they don't have any, you know, it's just, Aquinas does not have a totally reductive form of animal behavior. What they lack, though, is this ability to reflect on their desires and their life, and to order it. So dogs don't, you know, make elaborate plans. They don't plan for the future, except in very basic, you know, very basic ways. They don't, you know, they don't write jokes to each other the way we do. You know, they don't create art or abstract representations or anything like that. They've done studies with dogs where you take you habituate a dog to say the food is always in this corner, and then you bring the dog in, and this time the food is in that corner, and then you take the dog out and wait 5 minutes and bring the dog back in, and it will go first to this corner. Like its memory is rather limited, you know. So it's like a pretty sensual memory. Okay, it's interesting things that have been done with dogs. Now, here's just I don't want to get completely off track here, but an interesting, this is kind of my own speculation. But now we have increasing moves to regard dogs as people, you know, dogs are persons too, kind of thing, you know. Why? Well, when you have an impoverished understanding of human friendship, and when you think that human friendship is basically just on the emotional level, so I feel emotional comfort in being with my friends. If you think that love or friendship is just emotional connection, then, in fact, it makes sense because you can have a very similar emotional connection with a dog. The problem there is not in elevating the dog. The problem is in being reductive about what is human. So I think actually the better way to critique that kind of move is to say, you should have a higher understanding of what a person is than you currently have, and what friendship really is. Okay, but back to Aquinas on natural law. So he would say that human beings participate in a more perfect way in the natural law because we can understand and direct ourselves. But it's not to be reductive as with respect to the lower inclinations. And I think this will be important when we talk in a minute. Where I'd like to go after this is to talk about arguments about disordered desires and how we distinguish desires that are in accord with our nature and what is disordered. Okay, but there I see a bunch of other hands. We're still trying to get clear on what is natural about natural law for Aquinas. Yeah, Amadeus?
Rationality is not something that can change. So when you talk about like nature, you always have to talk about properties that things have, and how can these properties enable them. And Aquinas would say, in a different way than Kant would say, like Aquinas talks differently about inclinations than Aquinas does. In Kant, inclinations are in a way something negative that we have to work against.
Yes.
You know, our rational nature as a property enables us to see inclinations perhaps as a reason to act. Whereas in Aquinas, inclinations are something positive. You know, we have natural inclinations for love and friendship and the good, you know, that also make us human.
That's right, and this is a very, so let's come back to this when we contrast Aquinas with Enlightenment forms of natural law, because that's a very big difference, and it's a very important one, and understanding how inclinations, natural inclinations, or nature is a positive for Aquinas is very important for getting the whole picture. Yeah, Luke?
One of the things I think is crucial is that the natural often is interchangeable with the essential in Aquinas, right? It's the essential properties of the thing as opposed to the accidental ones that just might inhere. Where I think the typically modern way of thinking about nature is sort of as an aggregation of data points, right? And there might be a rough distribution, you can see a pattern, but there will be outliers. And there's nothing really to say that any of them is more core to the essence of the thing than anything else. And this is, I think, one of the objections about disordered desires that we'll get to, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Anthony?
Yeah, to the previous point about properties, just even the word, like how you have, where you have a substance, you must have natural law, because it's a kind of substance, and it's the kind of substance that it is because of the substantial form that it has, and that nature determines that it be configured in such a way that it can meet the last end that's proper to the kind of thing that it is. And so, that's like when you talk, yeah, I mean, it just makes sense to me to think about it as virtues, to talk about a perfection of a power, like a perfection of this thing from which activity flows by that the substance uses to act the way it's supposed to act. So you have like the last end first as the most prior, and then the form that goes on to shape the matter in such a way that this is a kind of substance that can function in this way so as to meet this last end. And that, I mean, where you have that, you have law. And so where you have any substance at all, you must have law. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. Brother Dieudonné, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
That is almost that way.
Okay. Pronounce it for all of us again.
Is it Dieudonné?
Dieudonné. Okay. But this is French for God-given, right? A gift
yes.
of God.
I'm just going to put this here so it records better the questions.
Yeah, I think what I would try to say, what is natural in natural law, according to Aquinas, I'm trying to think, is, I like the concept to start with, but is that concept, is that which pertains to my self-realization, my full self-realization, both horizontally as a historical subject, but also in the vertical dimension of it, as a transcendental object. So that which pertains to that my self-realization is natural. And I would say it is dynamic, because that self-realization is itself dynamic. And that natural, that's why I did not use a kind of predisposition, because that would say that it is a kind of a static, but natural in Aquinas is more dynamic. Yeah, but is those inclinations, if I can allow myself to use that term, those inclinations that help me, that geared me to my self-realization as a historical subject, but also a transcendental subject.
Yeah, okay, very good. So that you've had a very nice way of integrating or speaking about the dynamic nature, or we might say the movement towards perfection, and perfection as a natural end, but you're saying also a transcendent end. There's a transcendent end to the human person, and that Aquinas' understanding of natural law actually is open to that. Now note that Aquinas is going to give some distinctions about what you can say with respect to philosophy and what you need theology then to enter in, or faith, in order to talk about the supernatural perfection of the person. But his natural law theory is open upwards in that way to that kind of supernatural perfection. So I want to move on, but do you...
Yeah, well, I just wanted to get clear on the question that was asked earlier about natural law versus eternal law, in that, were you saying that Aquinas also sometimes uses the term natural law analogously to the way non-rational creatures participate in the human law, or the eternal law?
Yes.
It seems like here he's saying, or at least in the articles we read, he says non-rational creatures are subject to the eternal law in a way different from rational creatures insofar as they're moved by divine providence. And then the next, in Article 93.6, he says that the distinct thing about rational creatures is that they participate in it in two ways. One, with respect to the same way rational or non-rational animals do, and the second, by way of participation via reason.
So that's right.
That's the proper way. And
that's, yes, that's right. That's the more, I mean, so Aquinas is very good at making distinctions. Yeah. So he will sometimes say something like what you just recited, and then in other times he will say, well, they do participate in a certain, they do have natural law in a certain respect, but it's just in a qualified sense because they don't have a participation by way of knowledge and will, whereas we do. So we have the complete sense of natural law open to us, whereas brute animals do not. You know, they just have a limited participation. And you'll see that actually in some of the things that I was reviewing some texts, some other texts of Aquinas, very interesting texts that I'd not read before, that move in both registers. Okay, so what I'd like to kind of try and summarize here, but Michael, you have something?
I still don't know what's natural law. Like, is it the natural inclinations that fit, or is it the nature of the human being is a rational animal?
Okay, this is a good question. What is the definition of law? For Aquinas, an ordination of reason for the common good made by one with care of the community, which is promulgated. Okay, so in what sense does natural law fulfill that definition? Maybe this is a good question for Aquinas. Can you tease that out? You want to give that a try?
Well, so the first thing is when the promulgation occurs, the inclinations. So, but he says.
Yeah, so he says promulgation is by way of the fact that we exist in nature, and we can observe it around us, and we can observe it also within us. So that's actually important, not just that we like have our own sense of our own inclinations, but that we see nature around us and the way nature behaves, and we see what human creatures are and what human society is like. So it's not just like a Cartesian interior reflection, you know, where you just close your eyes and try and think about yourself and come up with precepts of the natural law. It's much more holistic. It's you live and you experience reality and you see the way the world is and you reflect on it. And so you come to some grasp of it because you have the light of reason. You're able to do that. And Aquinas thinks that, as you saw in 94.2, he starts off by talking about what is self-evident. And he immediately says, okay, now remember, things are maybe technically self-evident, but yet not known to many people. Why? Because they don't know the definitions of things. Or they haven't they haven't really thought things through. So they may be self-evident in themselves, but not self-evident to me. And that's, we experience that all the time. Like if you haven't studied geometry, you don't understand what's self-evident about a proof, but then, or what's self-evident about a geometric postulate, you know, like that the angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees or something. You don't know that yet. And so it's not self-evident to you, but if you understood triangles and you understood what we're talking about, then it would be self-evident. So as you work through things, you come to know more things that are self-evident. Okay, so he's not saying that everyone automatically knows everything about the natural law. He's saying that it is knowable to everyone in principle. And he is making a further claim, which is that the most basic things are really known by everybody. So what are the most basic things? Do you remember what he says there?
Self-preservation, promulgation of the species.
Well, the most basic thing, which comes even before that. Yeah, that's in the order of speculative reason and in the order of practical reason. That is, speculative reason is about knowing reality, knowing things in the abstract, principle of non-contradiction. But in the order of what you ought to do,
pursuit of the good.
Yeah, the good is to be pursued and evil is to be avoided. Now, what he means by that is not that you come to know some abstract command that is just handed down to you that you don't, like, you're just obliged somehow to obey it. What he means is that you, like everyone, not only naturally is inclined to what is good, but if you have the capacity of reason to make a plan for your life, you will naturally make a plan to achieve things that are good. And so as you're, like, if you're in a meeting with other people and you're saying, okay, what should we do? We can all start from the premise that we should seek the good. Okay, and then you would ask, all right, well, what's good for us? Well, that's going to be much harder to answer, right? We're going to have more disagreements as we descend into particulars. So he thinks that the most basic precept is really known by everybody, intuitively and immediately, and it's the first principle for any reflection on what we ought to do. What is to be done? The good. What is to be avoided? Evil. All right. Then he thinks that some of these basic truths, the most obvious ones, the ones that are closest to the natural inclinations, are also pretty much immediately self-evident to everybody. But that as you add particulars, it gets much less evident. And so there's much more room for disagreement. Okay, so that's in the order of our knowing the eternal. Let's go back to the definition of law and natural law. Okay, so how does it fit? So we've been talking about promulgation. Okay, what are the other aspects of the definition and how do they apply to natural law for Aquinas? Anthony?
The ordination of reason seems to be back to Luke's point, the content of, it seems to be, corresponding very closely with the essence of the thing, because it's God's wisdom that he's configuring by which, he's making this thing suitable for the common good, so that the thing can work towards the common good.
Yes, okay, so there is but how is what you're describing different from just the eternal law?
Well, I think the distinction is...
I'm going to go to Paul.
It seems that, he talks about order towards reason, that things can participate in that in two ways. One is actively and one seems passively, insofar as the mensura and regula can... as we are ordered and regulated, but also as we order and regulate it. So it's particular, I think, to the rational picture that we can do the active portion of that and regulate and measure in a sense. And so we can participate in the rationis ordinatio as rational creatures.
Yeah, very good. So we're both by reason grasping what the order is, and we are able to be agents in being provident, right? Provident for ourselves, provident for others. What about the efficient cause of law? That's in Aquinas' definition too. What's the element there about the efficient cause of law in the definition of a law?
The one who's in charge of the meeting.
Yeah.
Made
by one who has care of the community. Who's making the natural law? God, right. So God, who is the creator of the author of nature. So does that answer your question, Michael? How is natural law? What is natural law? It's not just the natural inclinations. The natural inclinations are not the law. The natural inclinations help us grasp the law. The natural inclinations are a feature of the reality and, in a way, give us access to the order. So I want to go back to something that Amy talked about, which was the idea of teleology. You know, that we don't see things just as like random existing things that are just in a kind of static, with a kind of stasis, but as dynamic things that are avoiding their destruction and in fact even seeking their perfection. Aquinas thinks that that is an aspect of all of reality. So you might say reality is dynamic, or more specifically that reality is ordered towards a goal. Everything acts towards the perfection of its being. So here's where the idea of goodness, which is also an absolutely fundamental category for thinking about these things, both in philosophical ethics or in natural law reasoning, or in law in general, but also in moral theology. This is why goodness is such an important category. Okay, so when Aquinas talks about teleology, what does he say? He says, well, everything desires what is good. So he tries to give a kind of definition of goodness as what all desire. We saw that in 94.2. And then he says, this is, what does it desire? It desires its perfection. And what is a perfection? He says this earlier in the Summa, in Prima Pars, Question 5, Article 1, 151, absolutely foundational article. You can write that down in the margin. Go read 151 about goodness in being. He says a perfection is an actuality. He's using the metaphysics of act and potency. So I am actually here and potentially next door. I could go next door and then I'd be actually over there and potentially here. That's the idea. So perfection, seeking your perfection, means you have some potential that you're trying to make actual, make to realize the potential. And that's the way it works in, you know, like if you're trying to become a great ballerina or a great classical musician or a great metaphysician or whatever, or a good lawyer, etc., a good professor, you're trying to actualize your potential and achieve a kind of perfection. What is actuality? Actuality simply is existence. I mean, existence is the, what we're talking about when we say to actualize a potency, we're talking about making what is not fully a being, fully in being. So you are like a ballerina in potential, and we want to make you a ballerina really existing. This is why to speak about goodness is just another way of speaking about being. So for Aquinas, this is like the metaphysical foundation for natural law reasoning. When you understand the kind of being a thing is, then you understand what it is seeking as its perfection. So beings that are in dynamic development seek naturally their perfection in being. And that is their good. And that is what the natural inclinations are pointing us to. So go back to the table of natural inclinations. We have five that we cataloged. And this is specific to the rational creature, the rational animal. So what were they? The first is to seek the good. That's the most basic. Then to preserve existence. That's going to be the foundation for like eating and drinking and building shelter and also self-defense and just war. Like you're going to find your justifications there. Then the third, as I'm listing them now, that's for procreation and upbringing of offspring. That has to do with guiding the sexual impulse, obviously, but also family life. And Aquinas will say generativity in the supernatural order too. So like the spiritual paternity of the priest falls under this category. Then the inclination to truth. Now we really are moving into the spiritual side of human nature. It's not just biological. It has to do with the fact that we are endowed with reason. And then your desire to live with others in friendship and love. So that's your power of intellect, your power of will. Those are perfected, or we're trying to see what are those perfections of the creature. And that is how the human being seeks it the perfection of its being. So natural law, then, is, for Aquinas, when you say what is natural about natural law, it is trying to understand what is the human nature and then drawing conclusions about what human beings ought to do. Okay, I see a bunch of hands here. You've been waiting.
I think you probably partially answered my question, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the way Aquinas uses actuality and potentiality, and maybe distinguish it some from the way we think about it today, especially in light of like physics. Because that's one place in Aquinas where I feel like I wind up defaulting back to kind of modern categories, and I'm not really sure what they're saying.
I'm not sure I know what the modern categories... I mean, what are the modern categories?
Well, that's part of my problem is, like, when I describe, you know, well, I'm actually here, but I'm potentially next door, that sounds like it's still modern categories, and I'm wondering, to some degree, what the distinction might be, because it seems like there's a distinction, but I can't identify it, and I don't know physics well enough or Aquinas well enough to sit down and say, okay, well, here's what this one says, here's what this one says.
I'm not immediately aware of a difference between the way we talk about these things. I mean, so for Aquinas, potency means that the nature has some ability to be, which is not fully real or fully actual right now, fully actualized. And actuality is simply the full existing of that. But I don't want to. This may take us down into a kind of footnote. So why don't we keep moving? Yeah.
Yeah. So perhaps you mentioned that we might get into this anyways, but I wanted to bring up some critiques that are often sort of labeled against what we just discussed.
Well, so hold off on that because I just want to kind of round out understanding what is natural in natural law for Aquinas, so that we can, because I want to talk about Enlightenment theories and other theories of natural law. That's where I'm going.
Sure.
Anyone want to add anything to where we are at the discussion right now? I want to kind of keep us moving along. Yeah,
just
Desmond?
A quick one. How do you respond to the question of various potentialities? Because if we're saying actuality is this perfection, well, the potentiality between you being in this room and that room, you know, there's the question of which one do you discern then actually bring you to perfection? And then if you look at it a wider scale, you know, you had that before you became a friar, you had the potential of becoming a friar. You also had the potential of perhaps becoming, you know, a rock star or something like that.
Right.
How do you discern?
I've always thought that I had the potential to be like an Olympic diver, and my parents just never gave me the lessons, you know.
Rock star friar.
Right.
Friar is one category, but... But how do you choose between what would be, we could see, in light of the virtues, of an apparent good that you have potential for, which would be the fame of being a rock star, but maybe the lifestyle of being very virtuous, and then the potential of being a friar?
Yeah. Okay. No. This is a classic question, and that's where we're going after we talk about enlightenment and new natural law. So apparent goods and real goods, and how we understand our inclinations. But it's obviously a very important question to reflect on for your own life. Like, well, what is the real good that I should be pursuing? You know, what is the highest good for me that I can realistically do, you know?
Which would bring you to that perfection.
Yeah.
Which one?
That's right. You had a question here?
I'm going to save it for the...
Okay, Luke, you're
I
good.
Also had
Paul, okay, you have a question about this?
I had an objection, so I'll save it.
Okay.
About the natural law?
Yeah, just what's natural about natural law in Aquinas? Have we covered that? Have we rounded that out?
He uses, I don't know if it's a metaphor or if it's at the cause and the effect when he talks about it is the light of natural reason or the imprint of God's light within us. And so if you take that on a natural level and not a theological level, it's fascinating. I guess that's a true enlightenment before we get to the enlightenment. That this is the light of God's reason within us.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He does think that natural law, I mean, how do we participate in natural law? We've received a light from God, which is the light of natural reason, which allows us to understand the world around us, and is the foundation for us being able then to order our actions, insofar as we understand what we are and what the world around us is like. So that is really, I mean, if you just think of natural law, I mean, natural law has acquired so much baggage, but if you just think of natural law in the most simple precept, most fundamental precept, like do the good. Everybody does that insofar as they're a rational actor. And Aquinas would say, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's natural to the human being. And it's a kind of first, like, you don't need much training. You're just going to behave that way. Now you may need, then when you want to say, okay, well, what is good after all? What is good for us? Now you need to start structuring your thinking a little more. But he thinks that there are real principles that you discover in nature, in the world, that is, in the world around you, and by reflecting on the kinds of things that are out there, that allow you to get some real purchase on that. It's not going to give you all the answers, but it is going to give you some answers. And some of them are actually very important answers. And he thinks that human law, okay, you read this about how human law is like a specification and derivation from natural law. Why is that? It's because that's what we're doing when we're gathered in a legislative assembly. If we're a legislative assembly, that's what we do. We say, okay, we're the Society of Civitas Dei. We're the Commonwealth of Civitas Dei. What is good for us? What should our first laws be? Let's write them down. And that would require us to understand in some way what we are and what we're for and what is the good for us. And this is not like we're feeling commanded by some precepts from the sky that we now have to insert into our law that we don't really understand, but they're kind of heteronomous to us, you know, it's like they're just being imposed. No, it's a totally natural way of behaving, and you begin with saying, well, we want to seek the good of our community. Okay, what is that good? Well, we want to be friends, and we want to kind of live in harmony with each other, and then we're going to have to specify further how we do that, and that's what Aquinas simply means by deriving from the natural law, the human law. And the human law is going to have certain limit. Like if we were to decree something that is totally contrary to natural law, then we would have done a really bad job. That's what he would say. That's why, like, you have gone wrong. So sometimes people invest a lot more, like, esotericism in this than Aquinas, I think, is thinking about. But he does think that this has real, like, real moral force. Okay, what I'd like to do is now reflect for a minute on what other theories mean when they say natural law. So let's think about the Enlightenment theorists. We might take John Locke, who's probably, I'm guessing, best known to us, most of us as Americans. What is natural about natural law for John Locke, insofar as you know, like Lockean natural law? Anybody? I mean, this wasn't assigned reading, so I understand if you... Maybe I should call on Dr. Munoz. Can Dr. Munoz...
It's an ordinance of reason. So it's the natural law, it's the law of reason.
But what is natural about it? Where does the word nature come in, if he says the law of nature?
Well, it's not conventional, right? I I mean, I would posit it's much as you just described for the last hour.
Okay, I don't agree. I mean, I so said contra. Yeah. Amadeus?
I think I remember, it's a long time ago that I read Locke, but he says something about, you know, that it's that the law of nature in a way, or the moral laws imprinted onto our hearts. And that's why the state of nature in Locke is much different than the state of nature in Hobbes, because we naturally act as virtuous because this law is written into our hearts. I think that's a metaphor he uses.
Yeah, okay, now you've added a new term, state of nature, which does have an important role there.
It doesn't dictate ends, right? So it's knowable apart from society, and it's the baseline, this is the state of nature idea. But it doesn't really have a teleological content in the same way.
Yes, okay, so now I think this is a very big difference. All right, so one difference would be talking about a state of nature. Well, how does that construct work in most of these now I may be kind of conflating Locke and Hobbes, and Dr. Munoz is in the room to tell me, like, oh, come on, you're not being fair. But here's my back of the envelope sketch, subject to correction. That for the Enlightenment, okay, what are some of the preoccupations that they have? First, they want to get rid of teleology. So that's out. They can no longer then talk about natural inclinations as kind of having a normative content or giving us some insight into what ought to be done. Now maybe Locke fudges the difference a bit, but then they use the state of nature to speak about the kind of original status that we have, from which we are endowed with certain rights, you might say, that we then can bring into political society by way of consent. So where does, if you want to use natural law by way of a kind of moral concept or with some normative content, where is the normative content coming from? It's not coming from teleology. It's coming somehow from this consent and what I bring into that consent from my natural endowments, like my property, my right to property, or my right to life, or my right to liberty, etc. Yeah.
Okay, so this is not me. I just finished reading Adam Seagrave's book on Locke's natural law. But he makes the argument that Locke, if I can remember it correctly, that Locke combines natural law, and in his argument, a very Thomistic version of natural law, with this concept of dual ownership, both God's ownership of myself and my own ownership of myself, and that aside from teleology, so without teleology, the moral obligation comes from both God's ownership of me reinforced by my self-command to my own person that I own, and thus the moral obligation comes from that dual command from God to me, from me to me, to do what I ought to do.
Yes, okay, so that's very interesting, but the author of that book is, I would say, not a good Thomist in the classical sense. Why? Because teleology is dropped out, which is absolutely central for Aquinas. And then what do you have? You're back in the nominalist category where it's the will, the command of the superior that is imposing the obligation, not the ordered plan, which has its own kind of internal logic. So that's what Aquinas is talking about when he's talking about the teleology. It's like that's a facet of the ordered plan which comes from God. It's not just that God has willed it. It's that God has designed it. Yeah, Paul?
And this may be a question for Chris Munoz as well. Is the fundamental difference, the aspect that when we were just reviewing natural law and Aquinas, one of the things you mentioned of the five, that the fifth one is the social in nature, but it's actually one of the four parts of the definition, ad bonum commune. So the question I have is that the political common good? Is that the natural intrinsic common good of the order of nature. But I guess the fundamental difference maybe is that that's baked into Thomas's vision, and it carries with it a teleology that human beings are by nature social. So the myth or the fiction of the state of nature is not only a creative fiction, but it's actually a very dangerous fiction because it implies that we're individuals before we're part of a family or community.
Okay, I think that's a very good point. Yes?
Yeah, I'm just going to say I think a fundamental difference might be just in the conception of the state of nature. I'm thinking of Rousseau specifically, but I think you can find it in Locke. There's this idea that there's sort of a corruption of man's nature the more he enters into society. Utopian ideal is, you know, getting back to that sort of individualistic state. Whereas St. Thomas, I think, would say that state never exists, and you know you're born into a family, and so there's already that sense of man's nature is most fulfilled in community, not least fulfilled.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, I want to give an opportunity for some other people to speak who've not. Sylvia. Yes, I think the three of you have just put your fingers on like different facets of the same idea, which is that for the Enlightenment thinkers in general, it seems to me, they want to they're looking at the human nature of an individual in a kind of atomistic way, and then you're moving him or her into society with a kind of consent, you know, so you then have agreement. And why is that important? Because that's how there's going to be some normative content to the relations in society. It's coming from the freedom of the individual who is freely consenting. Okay, that's why this is at the origin of modern liberalism, because the origin of it is my will. This is not Aquinas' view, because he thinks that to take an atomistic view of the individual is a great impoverishment of the individual. We are made to be in society. We are naturally in society. So you're born into a family, you're born into a neighborhood or a clan, you're born into a kind of political association, which he thinks is a natural reality that is also necessary for your perfection. So the man who is alone is imperfect. And you can verify this, I think, with a very simple thought experiment. Imagine you had all of the wealth and material comforts possible to a human being, and you lived on a desert island with no interaction with anyone else. Would you be happy? I mean, if you saw the movie The Martian, right? If you were able to build a paradise on Mars, but you're the only person on the planet, and you have no way to communicate with the rest of the cosmos, would you be happy? No, I don't think so. I think maybe a few people would agree to do that. But that would be a very lonely existence. We want to share our lives with other people, and to have friends, and to have love, and to pursue the truth together. These are great, great goods, without which the human being is deprived of something. So that on that level, it doesn't just work to say it's all just, you know, we can treat man as an atom and then use consent to move into the realm of society. Society is natural, and therefore there are things that we can say about it already. Yeah. Joseph?
I question whether or not Locke's view is necessarily antithetical to Aquinas' view. And I think there's a sense in which, a lot of thinkers, going back to Baudin, I think, and then much later, Frederick Bastiat and even Adam Smith, have this conception of the social contract as actually being in accordance with the divine will, and sovereignty actually being in accordance with the divine will. And so the sort of construction of society, you know, based on consent and on the social contract, actually exists within, you know, the eternal law. That's something that Frederick Bastiat would argue.
Okay, good. Can anyone intuit my answer to that? Amy, you... I think that's the heart of it is this shift in thinking that the will is first, it's divine, it's a divine command, and therefore a morality of obligation. That's why I think reading Pinkeris is so helpful, that book that I cited, which for me was like the Copernican Revolution or something, you know, from my thinking about all of these things. I realized all of a sudden it was like what McIntyre describes, where I have been operating with these terms and I never got them to fit together because I'm dealing with shards of a broken vase and I didn't know what the vase was supposed to look like. And so I'm putting it together and it's looking like, you know, some kind of misshapen plate or something. But it's not a plate, it's a vase, you know. So, or a vase. And that really helped me. So I do think that that's, in a way, what we're doing here is seeing how Locke uses very traditional language, and he says a lot of things that are true and that Aquinas himself would say, but he doesn't, the system as a whole doesn't fit together in the same way. And so you can read it and say, well, okay, can we reshape this and get it back to what it should be?
Right.
And this, I think the answer is, so we're Americans, we live in a political system that has a lot of debt to Locke, but that means it's also got a lot of debt to Aquinas too. Can we use the language that we've inherited and try and like reshape this back towards what it originally should be? And I think that's in a way part of what the project maybe should be. Since what we don't want to do is like say, okay, throw that out and let's have a constitutional convention and start over. Like, what would we get today if we did that? I mean, we'd end up with something very bad. So I'd rather work with what we've got. Okay, I want to move on from here to talk about the new natural law briefly. Luke, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, just two quick things. In fairness to the Enlightenment guys, especially Rousseau, he would say with your thought experiment of the Martian, you beg the question, because you're taking an already social person and depriving them of society. So of course they have wants and inclinations shaped by society, but we don't actually know what the pre-social being would be like. We've never seen that. So that's
yes, but isn't that also an argument in the other direction?
Yes, I agree, but it means that the question is more complicated and we shouldn't beg it, that's all. And just on Locke, if you read his educational theory, it's a lot less tempting to see him as Thomistic, because there he says it is nature is essentially plastic, and it really does depend on how your teacher imposes his will on you and mold you. So that's where I think the voluntarism comes through really strongly.
Yeah, Adrian, you want to?
Just briefly, we have two sources of data on people who reach something like adulthood or adolescence without social interaction. One is experiments on children who've been lost and survive on their own.
and the other is the sort of experiments that B.F. Skinner did on his own daughter, raising her in the Skinner box. And in both cases, I just urge you to check out the results. They're all, if they strongly support Thomas's.
But I think there's another very important subject that I'd like to talk about, which comes up when you talk about these inclinations, and that's the very serious contemporary objection that you will get. Well, look, we see different people being inclined to different things. Even in animals, you might see inclinations. Does that, like, how do you work that out? Okay, so you like chocolate ice cream. You know, I like strawberry. That would be a kind of maybe trivial thing. But where does this often go, or what's the subtext here? Often we're talking in the realm of sexuality. So you will get objections about natural law with respect to finding in primates masturbation. So, you know, the orangutan or something like that. Or some acts of homosexuality in the animal kingdom, something like that, in some cases. And people would say, well, look, there seems to be an inclination in nature for these acts. Therefore, that's also permitted by the natural law. But of course, the traditional Thomistic reasoning on this would point to those as unnatural acts or acts contrary to nature. Okay, so how do we make sense of that? Does anyone want to elaborate further on the objection? Have I stated the objection reasonably well?
Well, I think I see this objection at a few different levels, partially because the objection also appears in modern Chinese ethics. And so you've got one level that you just described that generally goes towards sexuality, but then there's another level that I think Finnis actually is trying to get at in his concept of the life plan. That in, and this goes back to the actuality and potency discussion from earlier, that when we connect actuality and potency with perfection and imperfection, it seems like we wind up saying that there's only one way to live, that, you know, is, you know, being a soldier is worse than being a scholar, is worse than being a priest, and thus everyone should be priests. And that seems to divorce a lot of legitimate and actual freedom of choice in the way we live our lives and pursue what God has given us to pursue by rigidly structuring the choices that we have to make in order to pursue the ultimate good.
Okay, good. Further objections along?
So in a similar vein to this, but it relates also to what we've been discussing in Professor Neal's class about intentionality of law, right? In that identifying the intention of a law doesn't mean that's a much more difficult enterprise than it might seem at first blush. So to say that you could make the objection to say that all sexual acts are ordered towards procreation just assumes the end already, right? Instead of saying if you were to discover various intentions for the purposes of sexual acts, right? So you could say that it's not only for procreation; it's also for pleasure or, you know, excess or something like that, right? So that would be another way of framing the objection that might tilt in the other direction, as opposed to saying.
Yeah. Brother? John Paul?
I'm not sure that I know myself what I'm going to say, but in case it is proved that homosexual inclination is natural in cause, I will not call it an accident in a natural inclination, because Thomas also speaks of accidents, even in nature. So I don't know what is your take on that, but that's what I understand.
Yes, and I don't want to make this just about the question of sexuality or homosexuality. It's just that that's where, in our contemporary context, this is most typically like immediately, you know, raised. But you're right. Okay, so let me just jump off from that, because that is one aspect of a Thomistic answer to this kind of objection about disordered desires or desires that don't conform with nature. Or we see different desires. Maybe we just be very neutral about it. We see most animals behave this way, but some animals have desires that point in different directions. So how do we decide which are the ones that are really natural and which are the ones that are not really natural? That's the issue, I think. And one way to answer that is from Aristotle and Aquinas, saying that nature is what happens always or for the most part. So there, you know, we do encounter defects that arise in nature, anomalies. You might just think of birth defects, you know. We recognize what is a blind dog as opposed to a seeing dog. And we say, well, the blind dog is not, it's not the nature of dog that makes the dog blind. There's something else that's happened that this particular dog, it hasn't worked out fully. And there, well, that could affect other behavior. So there could be something in the dog, this particular dog, that leads to a strange, you know, strange behavior that doesn't fit the norm. That, so where will Aquinas go with this? He will want you to look at the nature and what is perfective of the kind of thing that it is. So one critique of Aquinas under this kind of objection is to say, well, Aquinas is just being a kind of physicalist. He's just saying that whatever is normative. That's actually not the case. Aquinas is saying you look at the reality and then you have to use your mind to grasp what is perfective of the reality. And that is where the, you might say, the normative content of the natural law is coming from. It's not just the natural inclination is the law. It's that the natural inclination is helping you see what is perfective or good for the thing. And there are some inclinations that you might discover in natural things that are not perfective or that can go wrong. And we don't say that those are normative. So think about just our own natures. Now, we're more complicated creatures because we have experienced the effects of sin, so we have more easily disordered inclinations than most animals do. But we experience it in ourselves. Like, you can have an inclination to eat way too much food. And some people really never master this inclination, and they really endanger their health. So you can die from just grossly overeating. If you do that for a long time, you will. And likewise with drinking, like intoxicating drinks. We call it alcoholism. You can drink yourself to death, and there are some people who just cannot master that inclination. Do we say that because there are people who grossly overeat or who drink themselves to death, and that that's an inclination that occurs in nature, that therefore that is somehow in accord with the natural law? Well, no. In fact, what that shows you is that inclinations that are contrary to the good of the thing, I mean, they do eventually kill it. But they're not actually good. Like, if you take it to an extreme, it will ruin the thing. And Aquinas really thinks that we have to use our minds to sort of work this out with our inclinations. Father White, did you have something you were... Cosimo.
Fine, I well understood. The point is that the natural inclination of the natural law, say, is the inclination of the majority. It's the way that you identify the natural inclination, and then with the mind you realize that the natural inclination is correct.
Yes, I think in general, yes. I mean, I don't know, the first step is less important than the second step. But Right, that's true.
Can be the case that the natural inclination is the inclination of the minority. I mean, because also the future...
Yes. Well, with human creatures, it definitely could be. Because, for example, okay, so let's just go a little further. We have disordered desires, okay? Overeating and drinking too much, something that most of us probably have at some point encountered that desire and have had to try to master it. But sleeping too much, okay? Now, let's get beyond material desires and move into the spiritual realm. We can catalog a lot more of them, and they seem to be pretty endemic in the majority. So, manipulating others for our own ends, acting selfishly, towards avarice and hoarding. You might even say, listen, squirrels do that. There's a natural inclination to hoarding. And that's therefore in accord with the natural law. Okay, is Aquinas going to want to go in that direction? No, okay. Towards destroying the environment by wastefully using resources. Don't we see that in lions and wolves? Like they kill food that they're not actually going to completely consume. Or they will take the food of other animals. They will drive off another animal that's just killed the prey in order to keep it for themselves. Even gentle Bambi does this, right? They've discovered this in Yellowstone? Where they removed the wolves as predators, and then the deer population was there was an overpopulation of deer. They ate too much foliage, which destroyed the plants on the banks of the river, and so the river stopped meandering and started running in a straight, fast line, and it destroyed the habitat for all this different stuff. There's a documentary you can watch about this, about how reintroducing wolves reduced the deer population, which saved the whole habitat, okay? So deer are as bad at this, they're as culpable as anybody. So what do we have to then do? We have to try and discern what is actually in accord with nature, rightly understood, and what is destructive of it. And just looking at the majority of inclinations is not going to give us the answer, I think. So that is a guide. It's a first guide. But it isn't the final answer. There has to be an additional order of reflection. Luke, can I keep going? Or do you want to... Because I want to... We're running out of time and I want to get to a further point. Okay, so there are two texts that you could examine on this. One is the handout I gave you yesterday, which you can go back to, which is about natural and unnatural pleasures. So the first part of that text, I have more copies of it if you need it. I don't really want to spend a lot of time with it right now. I'm just going to tell you what's in it, and you can go look at it later, or I've got more copies if you need it. Aquinas distinguishes levels of nature, analogical senses of nature. We have the same nature we share with biological animals. And then we have the rational dimension of our nature, which has a higher range of perfections. So we can talk about what is natural for our animality, and that's true enough, but we can also talk about what's natural for our rationality or our sociability, and that is more perfective, more in tune with what we really are. Okay, then with respect to our pleasures, he says, it also happens sometimes that someone takes pleasure in something that's actually bad for you. And sometimes, he says, that happens from on the part of the body. So you get sick and your taste changes. And what is actually healthy for you, you don't like, and you want to eat things that are unhealthy. Or it could be an evil temperament, where you have a desire for something that's actually not good for you. We could add then, like addictions, like our modern understanding of addictions would fall into this category in some measure. But then he says, it can also happen on the part of the soul. On the part of the soul, this happens because you have become habituated to a vice. And your soul has in a way become deformed. And what are the examples he cites there? From some customs, some take pleasure in cannibalism or in the unnatural intercourse of man and beast, so bestiality. He thinks that there are some people who say, well, I like that, but that this is profoundly contrary to the nature. It's a defect of soul. It's not good for the being to do that. And yet there are some who will seek it out. Okay, so there are criteria for distinguishing this. All right, I want to conclude, we just have a few minutes left, by looking at a further case that is actually really fascinating, because most people immediately want to move to, in contemporary discourse, when you bring up this disordered desire question, or alterity of desire anyway, they will want to say, oh, well, masturbation, homosexuality, those are the first things that you go to. But Aquinas actually has a more interesting examination of polygamy. Now, polygamy, why polygamy? He asks the question, is polygamy contrary to the natural law? And very interestingly, Aquinas says yes and no. Why would he say that, do you think? Like, just what would be his initial motives for why he might say that?
No, on the level that we share nature with animals, because we see polygamy in animals maybe, but yes, it's unnatural on the order of the rational nature.
Yes, okay, you're giving part of the argument, but I'm just asking, like, motives. Like, why would he be motivated to, Paul? Yeah, you have this existing in some human societies. Even today, it's existing in some human societies. And you have Old Testament patriarchs who are polygamous. And do we want to say that they were contravening the natural law? As a theologian, is Aquinas going to want to say that? So when he treats this, it's actually very interesting. And obviously, in the animal kingdom, you do find widespread polygamy. So this actually is a better point to press the argument on than the very minor occurrence of masturbation or homosexuality in the animal kingdom, which really is very, very of minor in terms of quantity. So here's the arguments that Aquinas gives, and he treats this in several different places. He says, this is from the Supplementum to the Summa, question 65, article 1, if you want to look this up later. That's actually an edited version of an early text of Aquinas that he wrote called the Commentary on the Sentences. But it's easier to access because it's translated into English, this Supplementum to the Summa Theologiae. He starts off by saying, all natural things are imbued with certain natural principles by which they exercise their proper actions and belong to it by its nature. Okay, so man, by his nature, is both an animal and has reason. So this is along the lines of Paul's argument. Paul's intuited very correctly how Aquinas is going to go. He says animals act only on the appetites of their animality, so they couple with many. And there are some exceptions to this in the animal kingdom, Aquinas notes. Where do you find those exceptions? The species of animals where the father needs to be involved in the raising of the offspring. Now, interestingly, modern science does validate this. So, for example, the emperor penguin, you know, there's this documentary, The March of the Penguins, narrated by Morgan Freeman. You should watch it. It's about how emperor penguins, how the fathers carry the eggs hatched by the mothers on their feet for thousands of miles and endure these terrible conditions in the in Antarctica, hunching over the eggs to keep them warm. It's absolutely fascinating. And it's the males who do this, not the females. And as it turns out, emperor penguins are monogamous. So there are other animal species where this happens. So already Aquinas is pointing out, like, okay, even animals, when they need to have a father in the picture, are monogamous. But human beings have reason and not just animality. So they should not just be impelled like animals by their animal desires, but should reflect on their desires in light of the kind of beings that they are and use their minds to control their animal desires. So what is the end of human sexuality? He says that there are three ends operating on three levels. The primary end is the generation of the begetting of children. But then he says there is a secondary end, or a second end, which is family life. So family life requires a father to raise the children, so it's very important. Human creatures don't do well without fathers. Aquinas makes this point. It's very interesting. He says the father contributes in a unique way to the formation of the soul, and the mother in another way. That's controverted, obviously, in our day. But anyway, I think you could defend that. But he also says you need the spouses to be friends in order to have a happy life together. And that is a part of human flourishing. Just ask somebody who's divorced, who's gone through one of these bitter divorces, has that contributed to your happiness? Most will, you know, if they're honest, I think, will tell you the divorce produces a lot of misery. I mean, maybe they'd say, well, the marriage itself was staying in the marriage would have been worse, but divorce isn't a happy reality in general. So you're always sad when you see the failure of a marriage. So marriage actually is intending to produce a kind of communion of friendship, and Aquinas does think it's a friendship, that romantic relationship. It's a special kind of friendship that is a procreative friendship. So it's a unique friendship, but it is a friendship based on love. So that's the second end. And there, so Aquinas says, you can understand marriage just in accord with the first level. And so in that sense, it's in accord with the natural law to have polygamy. But it is not in accord with the natural law to have polygamy on the second level, because this is disruptive of a friendship between equals. And he very explicitly makes arguments about the equality of women with men. It's very interesting. And he says, you know, you can even identify who the father is and have the father in the picture if one man has multiple wives. It's much harder for it to work if one woman has multiple husbands. And he says, that's why polygamy is wrong, because it creates inequality and will tend to make the woman like a servant of the man. And then he adds a third level, and he says, a third reason for marriage, and this is a theological reason, to signify the unity of Christ and the church. He says polygamy completely destroys this. So he has some other arguments, which I won't go through. He treats it in several different ways. But that's the kind of basic. I think that gives you some window onto how he deals with this issue of diversity that you find in among animals. I mean, his answer is basically, okay, you're an animal, but you're a rational animal, so don't behave just like an animal, behave like a rational animal. And that means understanding what sexuality is about. And sexuality is about what I've just described, and not about just gratification for pleasure and so forth. Those are added on to sexuality. They're not contrary. It's not pleasure. In fact, he even makes this very interesting argument about against polygamy on the basis of the goodness of sexual pleasure. And this argument, I'll just throw this out there. I know that we're running out of time, but I found it surprising to discover in Aquinas. He says it goes contrary to all the stereotypes about what, like, a Thomist would say. He says, actually, there is the good of enjoying freely the sexual union. And that is a part of what it means to be married, to be able to enjoy this freely, that is sort of at will. And in with some, I mean, he has this idea of the conjugal debt, which is basically the spouses owe this to each other by virtue of their marriage bond. So they're not supposed to unreasonably deny just the good of coming together to each other. And he says, if you have a polygamous relationship, it's generally one man with multiple women, and that means that the man will have the free enjoyment of coming together sexually, but any individual woman will not, because she will have competitors. And that is unfair to the woman. That's interesting. So Aquinas really thinks that you should think about what you are and therefore draw conclusions. So I think I've probably run out the clock here. So I'll conclude and...